Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With Progressive's Name Your Price tool, you can find options that fit your budget. Because giving you options is the right thing to do.
Oh yeah, like when I hold the door for someone. Sure, it may be weird if I don't time it right, and they're a little too far away, and now they're running. And we're both asking ourselves, is it worth it to run instead of just, you know, letting them open their own door?
But still, it's the right thing to do. So get options based on your needs with Progressive's Name Your Price tool. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates and third-party insurers. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
I'm Dave Whitaker, and this is Vinyl Snob.
Rather than waste time and money going to college, I'm just going to work in a record store and go see shows, chase girls, and try and play in a band.
That's Tom Lynch, longtime record buyer for Amoeba Records in San Francisco. On this episode, producer Dana Barry continues his series, Confessions of a Vinyl Addict.
We're known for jazz more than anything else. I wouldn't say we're a jazz store by any stretch of the imagination, but our jazz collection runs really deep.
And in our visit to an indie record store, we chat with Jonathan Sandler, owner of Village Vinyl and Hi-Fi in Brookline, Massachusetts. All of that, plus vinyl news on this episode. First up, vinyl news. We're recording this episode in the middle of March 2020. Roughly 1 month after the devastating fire in Banning, California, at Apollo Masters, one of two companies in the world that manufacture lacquers, a key component in the pressing of vinyl records. In our previous episode, we spoke with Ron McMaster, who spent 37 years behind the cutting lathe at Capitol Records in Hollywood. Ron gave us the overall view of what this could mean to the industry. But with so many boutique mastering suites opening in recent years due to the popularity of vinyl, we thought we'd check in with what a smaller operation is dealing with. Joining us now by phone from Portland, Oregon, we welcome Gus from Sky Onion. Welcome to the program, Gus.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's do a little background. You do not only vinyl mastering, but you also do digital mastering, correct? You are a mastering facility. Tell us about some of the work you do.
So I do quite a bit of digital mastering. That's really most of my business. I've been full-time doing mastering for about 8 years, and I typically run about, 20, 25 jobs a month, which can be a small job like a single for somebody, or it can be a full LP, including vinyl masters, lacquers, instrumentals. And so it's a the scope of my work varies a bit, but since I've been doing it for quite a while, I have gained word of mouth recognition across quite a few different places, and so I get a good variety of clients coming through with different genres of music and different qualities of recordings, and just fun to do all that and help people release their music.
Now, you do digital mastering. Let's just touch on that briefly. I'm curious, this would be for sort of MP3s as the, I'm sure you did CDs at one time, but I can't believe that anybody is still manufacturing CDs.
Yeah, people still do CDs, believe it or not. I did some masters for CD, just this week I've done some CD masters, but a lot of people are focusing on Spotify, Apple Music, streaming, Bandcamp, that sort of thing. So that tends to be the release that most people end up listening to, just because of the way we consume music has changed so much. And but yeah, people still like CDs. In my opinion, they have a lot of commonalities with vinyl. You get the liner notes, you get the artwork. It's in your hand. It's not as physically impressive. And I prefer vinyl myself, but yeah, I think CDs are cool.
Let's get back to the Apollo Fire. Now, when you do your vinyl mastering, you have been mastering to lacquers for years, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. We purchased the blank discs in a box of 25 and put them on the lathe, cut each side. Usually it's one, one side goes on one disc. You don't cut the other side of the disc. And so it requires two lacquers to press an LP.
And you were purchasing those, as you said, in a box of 25. And were you buying them from Apollo?
Mostly. In fact, probably 98% of the lacquers I've ever used were Apollos. And luckily, I decided to try MDCs in December for the first time. I became one of the newest MDC customers. And theoretically, I will be able to get MDCs at some time, hopefully.
And MDC is the company in Japan, which is, well, now the only company in the world manufacturing lacquers, right?
That's correct.
And you said you received lacquers from them in January?
December, actually, where I actually received my first box of MDCs. And those are pretty much gone now. I have a few. I have a couple people on deck that have LPs that I need to cut. And basically, all my lacquers are reserved at this point for those people.
And was there any difference in quality between Apollo and the MDC?
Yeah, they're different. They cut differently. The Apollos are a little bit harder material, and the MDCs are a little bit softer or stickier. They both, it's hard to make them totally perfect, so they both have had imperfections at times, but I found that, for the most part, well, the box of MDCs I had, they seemed really nice. They cut with a really low noise floor. Some of the Apollos have had noise issues. You get some backgrounds, this background noise that a lot of times is undetectable, but sometimes you can hear it a little bit. And it seemed like Apollo's had more issues with that than MDC has.
Now, you said that what you have in stock is already sort of spoken for. Have you had any communication with MDC about what will be available in future orders? Early on, they were saying they were probably going to ration them, so somebody could come in and just, buy up the entire lot. Have you had any conversations with MDC about what will be available in the future?
Yeah, so I've talked to the North American distributor for MDC, and they receive one shipment a month from Japan. And, they're typically pre-sold. Even before the Apollo Fire, those were typically pre-sold. And I saw the day of the Apollo Fire, I saw that, and I had already been thinking, oh, I need a new box of lacquers. I'm almost out. So I emailed the distributor that day, and they replied and said, oh, yeah, we're getting emails from people all over the world. Everyone's freaking out, trying to get lacquers. And he told me that since I had ordered before, they can put me on the waiting list, but I was not an established long-term repeat customer. So my place on the waiting list is probably the bottom. And they said they would try to get me a box in the February shipment. And that ended up not happening. And they've now said, hope for March. And yeah, they're definitely rationing them out.
What about new customers? If, say, someone had always been an Apollo customer, now that MDC is sort of rationing out their product, any indication on what will happen as new customers come knocking at the door?
Well, since MDC was already at their peak production and they had a certain level that they were making and they were supplying their customers, they have basically said that they are not taking on any new customers whatsoever. They're just going to continue servicing the people that already use MDCs. And that's a problem for people that have not been using MDCs at all.
And you had one order before MDC, before the Apollo Fire, you put one order in with them?
Yeah. And so in December, there was a bunch of stuff going on. I felt like it was a storm of things that were happening where some of the stuff that I had cut was coming back noisy from a couple plating plants. And then there was a plating plant that ruined a bunch of my lacquers. I had to recut five releases because they just completely got destroyed in the plating. So I decided to try MDCs. I had talked to some people that had already switched and they said that they liked them. And so I finally placed an order, which I had been considering doing for about a year. Every now and then there'd be a batch of lacquers that have some noise issues, and I keep thinking, oh, maybe I should try and get these MDCs, but they were hard to get even then. You know, I talked to the distributor and they'd say, well, I don't have any now, but you can get on the list, and if we have enough and this month, then you can get them then. And you know, and so you kind of cross your fingers, whereas Apollo, you could just email them and they'd send you what you needed.
Wow. Well, good thing you put in that order in December then.
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I'm really kind of banking on this March order coming through. Yeah. So I got my fingers crossed, and I'm going to be nervous until the UPS guy shows up, but we'll see.
Any indication from your people at MDC that they can, you know, step up manufacturing, increase the output?
I believe MDC does not want to increase the output. They have a certain system in place, and they have a high quality standard. And I think that they've gotten as big as they want to get. And, you know, like with many products, it's a boutique product and it's very good. And then they ramp up their production and, you know, quality can suffer. So I think that MDC is just sticking with their model and their plan. And I doubt they will increase production.
It may just turn into there's going to be a wait. Any thoughts that another facility may try to sort of fill the void left by Apollo?
Yeah, well, there are definitely several companies that are working on making lacquers currently. There's a couple companies in Europe for sure. It will happen. There will be new lacquers from a new company and, you know, possibly even new formulations. This nitrocellulose lacquer that they're using is old technology. Material sciences have advanced a lot, and there's a chance that a chemist can come up with a new compound that performs better and is more consistent and, you know, maybe hopefully cheaper, but we'll see about that.
And that would be great. The initial reaction to the Apollo fire was, oh my God, what's going to happen now? But, you know, MDC, it sounds like they will, you know, somewhat fill the void. And these other manufacturers coming in, I mean, if there's a need, you know, someone will develop it, how long that takes and what the price would be. You know, we would just have to wait and find out. I'd like to, you know, pick your brain a little bit because there is another option, as I understand, to standard lacquer masters, which is the metal mastering.
Right.
What can you tell me about the differences between those two formats?
Well, the actual process of cutting them is different. You need different equipment. The lathe itself has to be much more robust. You know, the copper discs, as you can imagine, when that cutting stylus drops down into that copper, there's a lot more drag induced by the copper because, you know, that material is, you know, magnitudes more difficult to cut than the lacquer. So you need a much stronger motor for your turntable. And then the stylus, you know, you need a diamond stylus instead of a sapphire or a ruby. And the cutting head itself needs to have, you know, stronger magnets and, you know, more horsepower, essentially more wattage available to it to cut into the copper. And then the suspension that holds the head needs to have more juice available in order to do the variable depth of cut that that many lathes have. So there's a lot of differences, and therefore there are very few lathes out there that are even able to try to cut copper.
Is there any difference in quality between the two that you have seen or have heard of?
Well, yes, they do sound different. I think that it is harder to get a really loud, bassy cut on copper because, you know, by definition, those cuts are deeper, bigger grooves, and it's just more difficult physically for the head to do that. I think a lot of the perception of DMM masters comes from what people have heard, the pressings coming out of GZ Media in the Czech Republic, who is the biggest pressing plant in the world, as far as I know, they pretty much use DMM masters for the majority of their releases. And they cut, I think they cut fairly conservatively. They, you know, they try to just get it on the disc and not push the limits. So I think a lot of people have heard those cuts and are judging the potential of DMM based on what GZ has done. And I think that it could be done differently. And so yeah, I think there is a sound associated with it, but it's possible that it could be better than what we think it is.
After the master is cut, whether it's lacquer or DMM, is the manufacturing, the pressing at that point, is it the same or is it different?
Well, it's different. One of the reasons DMM was developed was so that it would be easier to make the stampers. So with the lacquer, the way you make a stamper is you have to turn it into a metal negative, like the mold. You take a mold of it, but the mold has to be metal so it can go onto the pressing plant. So in order to do that, they take the lacquer, they spray it with a very thin layer of silver so it will conduct electricity, and then they can attach the anode, or I don't know the terminology for the thing that conducts within that plating bath, but they hook the lacquer up to that and they put it in a nickel bath, and they'll let it sit in there for hours, and then the nickel gets attracted to that silver, and eventually you can pull the lacquer out and peel off the metal layer, and that can be used as a stamper. But typically they do another couple versions of you know, they make negatives of that and another negative, and then you have your stamper that goes on the press. But with DMM, you don't need to silver it. It's already conductive. And so it makes it simpler to make the stampers. And theoretically, you can have less noise issues and less potential problems in the plating.
So you eliminate, with the DMM, you're eliminating the plating process completely then?
No, you're eliminating the silvering process of the plating. You still have to make a metal negative to get it onto the press. So they still do the metal work. It's just the process of doing the metal work is different and a little simpler. It's a shorter chain to get to a stamper using a DMM.
Then at that point, the manufacturing process is identical.
Right. Once the stamper's made, whether from lacquer or from DMM, they just put the stamper on a press and away you go.
You said it requires a different lathe, more horsepower. Is that something that you have to manufacture from the ground up, or is it something that could be retrofitted, say, to your Scully lathe?
I believe it would be possible to retrofit a lathe. It depends on how much work you'd like to do. You know, you can do about anything. You could retrofit a Scully for DMM. I don't know if anyone's ever done that, but it is possible. Part of the problem is these motors that are capable of DMM that are out there and established, and we know they work. You can't buy them. They're very few made originally, and those that have them use them. And so you'd have to come up with something new, which is possible. But again, then you're just in that experimental field, and who knows how long that takes and how much money you go through trying to solve that problem.
And if you were to make that change, I'm assuming you wouldn't really be able to make a change back then at that point.
Well, you could if you had a couple different cutter heads and cutter head suspensions. You could remove the DMM suspension and cutter head and put on your lacquer suspension and cutter head. The lacquer doesn't care that your torque on your platter is greater. You know, mm-hmm. It'll be fine for lacquer or DMM. So it's possible to have a setup that can do both. But the reality is that most people that are running these lathes have enough business. They don't want to break down the machine and recalibrate and go through all those steps because it's wasted time. Typically, those that have DMM do DMM. Those that have lacquer do lacquer. And they don't go back and forth.
You might be able to do it, but who knows how long it would take or how much it would cost.
Yeah. Well, and the cutter head is the real motor technology. Is there's a lot more of it out there, and there's a lot of things that could, you know, potentially be adapted to work for the platter motor, but it's the cutter head that is the real problem. There's just not a lot of DMM capable cutter heads out. And, you know, creating a cutter head that sounds good at all, cutting any material, is extremely difficult. You know, the last real innovations were in the 80s, and that was DMM. But really, by the mid-70s, the technology was, it's very similar now to what it was in the mid-70s. The differences between the 50s and the 70s, you know, of course, there was stereo, and then the lathes became more intelligent. They are able to vary their lines per inch automatically and, you know, have variable depth of cut. And the cutter heads got better. They started sounding better. So, yeah, there was quite a bit of advancement up until, I'd say, the mid-70s, and then things sort of plateaued.
And how did you get into vinyl mastering?
Well, I've always been a vinyl collector, vinyl lover. I worked in a record store throughout the 2000s. As a music fan, I love that format. I love the physicality of it. I love listening to it. And so as a mastering engineer, it was always kind of a dream to be able to get into cutting. And when I realized, after several years of mastering and getting established, I was working on projects that were being cut elsewhere. And I just thought it would be great to be able to do it myself and, you know, learn that whole aspect of the business. So I started looking for a lathe, and, you know, eventually found a lathe that would work, and just embarked on the process of learning how to use it, restoring it and improving it. And it's been quite a process over the last 8 years.
Well, and your studio is beautiful. I invite people to check out the link on our website, vinylsnob.com. By the way, how many lacquers do you have on hand?
Well, it kind of depends. I have some perfect ones in a box, about six of those. And then I have a quite a large stack of lacquers that I, for some reason, when I pulled them out initially, I decided not to cut them. Maybe there was a tiny little cosmetic flaw, or maybe I test cut and they were a little noisy. But so I have a lot of those lacquers. We'll see if I need to dip into those. Obviously, I would tell, you know, my client that, hey, I can cut it now, but it's got to be on these, or we can wait for hopefully a new box of MDCs. But yeah, I'm okay for now. But the real problem, actually, MDC does not make 10-inch lacquers, which are used to cut 7-inch masters.
Oh.
So just about everyone that was using that, even that were MDC customers, they were still using the Apollo product for their 7-inches.
Right.
So that's done for now. I mean, you can still cut a 7-inch master on a 14-inch disc, but those discs are more expensive, and it's more expensive to plate them. I imagine 7 inches are going to be, that's where, you know, those are really going to slow down, I think, more so than the 12 inches.
Interesting. I had not heard that. All right. Well, thank you again for all your time, Gus. And we'll check back and see if that order shows up here in a few weeks.
Okay. Sounds good.
Our thanks to Gus and everybody at Sky Onion for taking the time to speak with us. After the break, Dana Barry will be here with another installment of his series, Confessions of a Vinyl Addict. Welcome back to Vinyl Snob. I'm Dave Whitaker. And now, continuing his series, Confessions of a Vinyl Addict, here's producer Dana Barry.
I recently sat down with Tom Lynch, longtime buyer for Amoeba Music in San Francisco. His knowledge is almost overwhelming, and a perfect guest on Confessions of a Vinyl Addict.
The first record player was from my Aunt Winnie, and I got her kid's portable record player, and it came with three 45s. Freddie Cannon on Swan doing Palisades Park, but the flip of Palisades Park was his Little Richard sound-alike number, June, July, and August. So that was a favorite in that, and the Marvelettes, Don't Mess With Bill. Tennessee Ernie Ford doing Your Cheating Heart on MGM. Kind of set me up for, like, unhinged rock and roll, soul, and country. Like, when I turned 8, the Beatles 62 to 66 collection had come out, the Red Album, and the 67 to 70 collection, the Blue Album. So I got those and then a stack of comic books. And I measure all birthdays in gift exchange. Like, well, is it going to be as cool as that?
So while kids like me were playing kickball, Tom sat on the edge of the playground with a radio plastered to his ear, listening to the theme from Shaft. When others were headed off to college, Tom had other ideas.
It was the 80s. Reagan was president. Well, this guy's going to have us nuked any time now. So rather than waste time and money going to college, I'm just going to work in a record store and go see shows, chase girls, and try and play in a band. Full Moon Records was the first store I worked at, and they opened in 73 or 74. And they were known for cutouts and jazz imports and a lot of marijuana smoking paraphernalia. The guys that worked there, they were all jazz heads. Whenever I hear Mahavishnu Orchestra or Steely Dan or Pat Metheny, I have vivid recollections of going in there before I worked there and all these guys with mirrored shades and bushy beards smoking Sheriff Beatty cigarettes and smells just like dope. Hey, you need help, kid? Okay, man. All right, just let me know. The guy goes back to his racing form. There's a guy who was always playing the ponies there. I think his name was Don Fordham. He was a jaded soul. Well, after Full Moon, I worked at a place called Sam's Jams, which was on 9 Mile Road in Ferndale, which was right across from Detroit, the 8 Mile Barrier. And that was the best store I ever worked at. And I basically refer to it as like, those were my college years. I fell in with a bunch of guys who were much older, seen a lot more, experienced a lot more, and shared all that knowledge. I got there right before the horrible shift to compact disc. Even after the store closed in 94 and it became an art supply store, a friend of mine who I worked at the record store got a job at the art supply location. You'd still get these old dudes coming in with boxes of Coltrane and Sun Ra records going, "Where the record store, man?" He's like, "Well, they closed, but I'll buy your... Oh, is that Ornette Coleman? Yeah. I'll buy that off you." Yeah, that's the store where I started buying used records. You know, my friend who picked me out of all the other new recruits pulled me aside. He's like, "You want to be a used record buyer?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'll be a used record buyer. What do I got to learn?" He's like, "Well, just stand there and buy everything that comes to the front door." I'm like, "Yeah, but at how much?" He's like, "You'll find out." No, it was mostly like, "How much am I getting for that?" Oh! But it also taught me how to negotiate. And how to approach it, how to read people. And that was something completely unheard of when I arrived here on the West Coast. That was a component that just didn't seem to exist. Like, you had one chance to hit the mark for the customer. And if you didn't get it, well, they were picking everything up and walking out the door. And you're just like, whoa, what were you thinking? 9 times out of 10, I found it was like $5 or $10 difference. Like, well, I'll give you that. Come on, that ain't anything. It's pretty weird. And the guy who trained me to be a used buyer, I had a circumstance where this guy melted down on me and it wasn't any fun. And then I talked to my friend about it. And it's like, when they don't like your offer, just say, "What were you thinking?" You're basically, what do you want? If they say something outrageous, it's like, yeah, keep it.
Tom mentioned cutouts earlier. For those of us who aren't exactly sure what cutouts are, Tom explains.
They were like records that stiffed somehow or were factory overruns. Stores would return them to wherever they purchased them, and probably 9 times out of 10, they were purchased from one-stop dealers. And then the one-stop dealers would cut probably with electric clippers, you know, a corner in the upper right-hand corner. Or in the 60s, they seemed to like punch holes in the upper right-hand corner. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you'll see a lot of the 45s where it's drilled. All that stuff was like stock that had been returned to distributors, and then they sold it off to the dealers that would sell them as like no returns. This is dead stock. get rid of it, put it out cheap. You know, some of it was garbage, but like when you see some of these punched album covers from the 60s and it's like the Shangri-Las and International Submarine Band, you get like the, because it wasn't the Beatles or it wasn't the Stones, if it didn't fall into that parameter, a lot of stuff just did not sell on LP. Discount stores, you could go in and like get all that stuff for like $1.39 LP or, you know, 30 cents on a 45. But yeah, cutouts, Scorpio, man, in the middle 80s, like they would have just tons and tons of imports, quote unquote imports, from Portugal, Spain, Italy, and Greece, of like the entire Ramones catalog, the Fall catalog, loads and loads of reggae records, and PIL's Metal Box, and the Motorhead No Remorse with the fake leather jacket. And like they were also sitting on unsold quantities of all of the early Lennon Apple stuff, like the Live Peace in Toronto record with the calendar still inside, and the Two Virgins record, and Life with the Lions, and stacks of the singles. That's why those like Mind Games and Imagine and Power to the People, you see tons of them in perfect shape, because Scorpio was just going, hey, he's dead, I found this warehouse, just come and get it.
Whenever I interview a store owner or a buyer, I always ask for stories of great buys or finds.
Well, back at Sam's Jams, there was a disc jockey by the name of Ernie Durham, and he was one of the first black DJs in Detroit, and he was on WQHB AM, and he was known as the Frantic Ernie D. And then Ernie died, and his son came into Sam's Jams, and he's like, you know, my dad shopped here all the time. He'd want you to buy up his collection. A disc jockey, a black disc jockey, who'd been in radio since the late 40s, early 50s. Every dealer in town went to Ernie Durham's funeral looking to get in good with his lovely widow, Jackie. And then his kid's like, oh yeah, why don't you call my mom? That became this insane soap opera. And Ernie, when he got out of radio, he started working for Casablanca. This was at the time of when Kiss was on the label, and when Donna Summer and Parliament, one of the locations that things were housed in, he and his wife had near the campus of the University of Detroit on Livernois Avenue, Ernie Durham's campus ballroom. We went to the old location, and you know, it was in the wintertime, it was really cold, it was really dark. Get out the flashlights, and there's all these gold records piled up for Kiss Double Platinum and Donna Summer and the Village People. And there was like acetates from Jim Stewart at Stax to Ernie going, you know, here's the new Sam and Dave, I think you're really gonna love it. But it, like I said, it was a total soap opera, because there were some family friends who were snaking records away. Some very rare Motown records went missing and sold at this tiny little store, this place called Soul in the Hole Records, and that's where a bunch of this stolen stuff from the Ernie Durham collection wound up. It just kept going in terrible directions. Mm. It finally blew up, and somebody else intervened and finished off buying the rest of the collection.
This one's about as close to buried treasure as you can get.
These guys were demolitioning a storage unit out in Waterford, Michigan. But that's where the Cream magazine offices moved to when they left the Cass Corridor. So they moved all the way out there and did Cream there for a few years. And then they moved to the more urbane Birmingham neighborhood. And they put all this stuff in storage and left it there. And it was promo boxes from like the early 70s of records. And back issues of Cream and t-shirts and those little enameled Boy Howdy crumb designed pins. I'd be calling my friends and going, get over here now. These guys were bringing in boxes and boxes of this stuff. Bob was like, man, I think this is the Cream magazine stock. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, it's like Waterford, that's where they were. I'm like, okay. And we're like, all right, what's going on? Oh, we're tearing down this storage unit out in Waterford, and we found all these records, and we heard you guys buy records. So. And it was like promo copies of all the Zeppelin stuff and all the Black Sabbath stuff and reissues from RCA and Chess and Columbia and jazz, blues, soul. But it was like the back issues when Cream was still like in newsprint, fold over. It was pretty great.
I always love hearing about the shady characters that frequent a record store. I can only imagine what creatures roam the aisles of Amoeba.
See those jazz collectors every single day. It's like, come on, the stock doesn't change that much. I got one regular customer. If you've got the right record in the right shape, he'll fork over $1,500 no problem. He's a huge punk rock collector. And then there's the bottom feeders who are in there all the time buying all of like the $2.99 and dollar stuff. There's the clearance CD guys. Yeah, man. There's this one guy, he's loathed by everyone. He comes in there and he just like spends all day in there making sure it's all first editions, goes to every last section in the store, and of course it's for resale. And you know, he's even tried to like bribe people to like look at the clearance records in the back room. Like, I'll give you $20 if I can look at a box of clearance. I'm just like, just take the money, go upstairs, go across the main floor on the catwalk, and go out the front door. You've made $20. That guy will be sitting at the back door waiting. And he'll never do that again. But yeah, you know, just as it's a sickness to collect as much of this stuff and stay working in record stores as long as I have. There's the regular customers, there's the bottom feeders, the big game hunters, and the flippers. It's the game of, you know, diminishing returns. How much stuff from the interesting years of 20th century music, how much of the good stuff is still lying about? I mean, it's in private collections. I mean, we mostly see really interesting things when like people die or people are forced to move or they get divorced, and that's, you know, it's always sad. The emotional attachment to the music collection is palpable.
Tom is also a collector. In fact, we sat in the shadow of a giant record shelf on one side and a tower of about 20 boxes of yet to be filed 45s on the other. Go to the webpage and you can see for yourself.
Like, I'm never going to be collecting punk rock collectibles. I'm never going to be collecting high-end jazz releases. I'm happy with a reissue. Affordability is key. And if you spend all your time scraping the cream off the top of what comes in, then you're not going to have anything to sell. I haven't figured out what the next step in life is, so, you know, we got to keep selling cool old records. But what I find is there's plenty of stuff that where my interest is there's lots of it around and nobody wants it. You know, my fascination with exotica or lounge, those terms tend to be pretty broad, but there's stuff in that file that I'm endlessly fascinated with. I look for the interesting title on a 45. You know, sometimes it's a total disappointment, but a lot of times it's an interesting piece of music to me. Everybody's got one or two records. And the Ames Brothers included, they've got one song, My Rock and Roll Shoes. Check it out. It's pretty good. But there's all this stuff that nobody wants and you can get it cheap, and if you have the time to check it out. There's some fun, interesting, left-of-center records that got made by totally square artists. Anything that's got a little pizzazz. I try to tell people, go for the Triumvirate records or Armand Duel too, but don't forget about Earl Grant and the Ames Brothers. Okay.
As any addict will tell you, they can kick their habit for brief periods of time. I was surprised to hear how long Tom's abstinence lasted.
I moved out here with 25 CDs. I was living at my brother's apartment, and then I got my own place. It was always limited space. And, you know, these goddamn records take up a lot of a lot of space. I cooled it. I didn't buy any 45s. I hardly bought any LPs. I probably bought like, you know, 20 records in a couple of years. I dedicated a lot of time to that before I came west. And San Francisco at that time had so many rep movie houses. I was really scratching the itch of seeing as many films as I could. And the bookstores. Maybe I just traded one vice for another.
Right.
You know, the endless negotiation.
Any last thoughts on being a record buyer in the digital age?
One of the things that I find that's lacking is for San Francisco, so many of our regular customers have had to move because they can no longer afford to stay. And there was that community of fans who wanted to talk about, you name the genre, the artists, the records. Having that community constantly coming in, talking about records, recommending records to one another. Now people come in, they have their own agenda. They don't need to talk to anybody, looking things up on their handheld device. You don't have that same interaction, and I miss that.
I want to thank Tom Lynch for being such a gracious host and terrific guest. This is Dana Barry for Vinyl Snob.
On our travels around the country, we always like to stop in and check out the local record store scene. In this episode, we visit Brookline, Massachusetts.
I'm Jonathan Sandler. I own Village Vinyl and Hi-Fi in the Coolidge Corner section of Brookline, Massachusetts. First of all, I'm a lifelong music fan. Grew up when I was younger working in record stores. Tried to grow up. And here I am, back where I belong.
A lifetime vinyl collector, he started the store with his own collection.
Most of my collection I got rid of when I started the store. With, you know, I bought a few other collections, but I had a pretty vast collection to start with, and I wanted to start strong, and, you know, it just seemed like the right thing to do. I've been in this location for 9 months now. I had been in a much smaller location in Brookline Village, where I live, hence the name Village Vinyl.
Surprisingly, the desire to open a store was not based just on a love of vinyl.
Stereo equipment, believe it or not. I had really gotten the vintage stereo bug and had been doing that for a few years, sort of just amassing it and learning to work on it. I worked for a few different local shops, you know, learning to repair a little bit. The stock, as it were, got so vast that it was time to start looking for storage spaces just to get out of my house. I started thinking about, you know, what about putting the stuff back into circulation and, you know, having a store with records. And the original store wasn't that much more expensive than a storage unit would have been. It was in a basement, yeah. You know, there are a lot of stores in the area. Some record stores do have equipment, but they don't offer repair service, and, you know, the equipment that they have is limited, and, you know, there's no sort of warranty on it usually. Right. And then there are high-end stereo stores as well that offer repairs and things like that, but no store really fused those two concepts.
In its current location, Village Vinyl and Hi-Fi owes a lot of its success to the neighborhood.
A ton of walk-in here, yeah, which is great. The last location was more of a destination. You could literally walk right by it and not even notice it. Okay. So I'm paying 4 times the rent here that I was paying in the last location, but doing more than 4 times the business, so it's awesome. All the customers from the old spot, you know, traveled over here. You know, it's walkable even. It's close. Right. But, you know, people from Boston are noticing it more now. People come here shopping. People come here for restaurants. There's a great movie theater that drives a lot of traffic. Bookstore brings a lot of people here. I love doing systems for people. People just getting into vinyl, you know. They need, you know, the trifecta of a turntable or receiver, speakers. Mm-hmm. I usually get a sense of someone's price range, and then I give them a really good package deal. Say if they're willing to spend up to $250, they'd probably get like $325 to $375. It's discounted. For me, A, it gets stuff out of here, and B, you know, it usually creating a customer.
Having worked in record stores years earlier, Jonathan had no idea what to expect when he opened the doors to Village Vinyl.
Honestly, I had no idea how it was going to go. Couldn't believe some of the prices I was seeing in them. Quickly realized when I opened here, like, wow, you know, people are willing to pay good money for even things like Billy Joel records and things like that. It's incredible. Even just my first day in business, and I continue to be just blown away by the response and the collective desire for vinyl. You know, mind you, last time I worked in a record store was in the actually mid-90s, and vinyl was, you know, was dirt cheap, and CDs were the thing. It's amazing, yeah. For some reason, things go in cycles. Like for a few weeks last year, people were coming in and buying all my 10cc records. I don't know why. I don't know if they were in a soundtrack or something. So I love that. For Christmas this year, everyone's asking for Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons records. Like, huh? Really? So for me to have this space down here, which I know the people who are listening can't see, but it's all the records that people don't usually ask for, but if you have space, you hang on to them because someone might ask for them. So come down here and grab all your Frankie Valli records and bring them up. So it's, you know, in my last space, I had to basically give them away. Just didn't have space for the bottom shelf stuff. We're known for jazz more than anything else. I wouldn't say we're a jazz store by any stretch of the imagination, but our jazz collection runs really deep. Jazz heads usually come in, or even just, you know, someone getting their feet wet and getting their first pile of jazz records. People usually come in here and leave with something. Yeah. That said, you know, we're very strong on metal. I think we've got more classic rock than anyone in town. We're just trying to get cool stuff. I grew up listening to that stuff, so I'm very well versed in it. What's amazing is the prices. Had I just kept all that stuff and the T-shirts and everything, you know, it makes you know, the chase of finding it again, you know, plus other stuff in a collection, just that more, you know, exciting. You know, you mentioned Discogs, and a lot of stuff will come in where it's like, you know, this box is garbage. You know, why did I take this in at all? So I'll go down to the basement. And then you look up one thing you hadn't seen before, and oh my God, that's a $100 record, and you instantly beat the pile. My Best Buy was very much a calculated thing. When I opened up my first store, which I've since moved from, a few months into it, a collector who had gotten out of collecting and had sold his stereo years ago but still had all his vinyl, he lived in Newton, Massachusetts, he's a doctor, really nice guy, bought a ton of records, almost to the point of an obsession. Like, there are certain records he had 15 copies of. It was a 6,000 record collection, jazz, rock, classical, exquisite pieces, like really, really, really good stuff. He knew what he had, but I saw the collection and knew that I was never going to see a collection like this again. This guy, person of means, who pretty much was able to buy whatever he wanted before everything was, you know, priced like it is now. He was buying well into the 90s when records were no longer a thing. Anyway, I went to see his collection, had to have it, spent all of the money that I had made doing the business, emptied the account, and then some. That pretty much made my store. I spent, you know, in excess of $20,000 on it, you know. It was all the profits this shop had made. But, you know, It was the collection of a lifetime. You know, and what kills me is other stores in town had seen that collection and no one bought it. That's the kind of collection, you see it, and if you're a record store, you take a loan, whatever it is. You do whatever it takes to get that stuff. Tons of original Blue Notes. I sold one of the classical records for $1,500. I'll probably never get a collection as good as that. We get punk collections sometimes that are amazing. It's really people who were there back in the day whose collections you want to get. So when I meet someone, you know, someone who was there, they were trading, you know, 7 inches with their friends, or someone who, you know, you knew was a big collector and was really into metal or jazz, you know, psych, prog, whatever it is, you know. It's like, we're good on Bob Dylan records here. I don't get excited when someone brings me a pile of Beatles or Bob Dylan or Rolling Stones. It's just like, I have more of those artists than I'll ever sell. It's the more esoteric stuff that gets you excited.
That's Jonathan Sandler, owner of Village Vinyl and Hi-Fi in Brookline, Massachusetts. photos of, and links to his shop are available on our website, vinylsnob.com. And that's the program. Vinyl Snob is produced at the studios of Post Audio in Eureka, California. Dana Barry is our executive producer. Theme music composed by Cameron Robbins. Front Office handles all the social media. You can always reach me by email. In fact, the first 5 people who can email me and tell me the name of the only company in the world still manufacturing lacquers for vinyl mastering, the answer was in Vinyl News. We'll send you a Vinyl Snob t-shirt. Dave@vinylsnob.com. And if you find this program in a couple of years, yeah, you may still want to enter the contest. We've got a few prizes from previous episodes still yet to be claimed. Apparently not everyone makes it to the end of the show. What are you going to do? For more great podcasts, be sure to check out all the other programs here on the Pantheon Network. And for pics and links to this show, the episodes page at vinylsnob.com. I'm Dave Whitaker. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, this is Brian Reisman, host of the podcast Side Gems, which is now a proud member of the Pantheon family of podcasts. I've been a freelance entertainment journalist for 25 years now, and I often end up in conversations that go off on tangents. Suddenly you're discussing someone's outside passion or hobby, something you didn't know about, and it leads into revelations about their character and about their life outside of their art. I've often had to cut those details out because a story had a strict word count or a specific focus, so here, the entire focus of the podcast is just on their side jam or side jams. For example, Alice in Chains frontman William Duvall spent some time talking to me about reading history, which led him into talking about his public school education and how it was so terrible in high school that he actually managed to get into a private school for free so his life could take a different course. In this series of podcasts, you're going to be hearing my interviews with musicians of all different backgrounds and genres, talking about everything from surfing to collecting antiques to stargazing. I hope you enjoy Side Jams. Please tune in regularly, and I'll have a lot of interesting guests in store for you.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.